From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Birock, and this is Arizona Spotlight. A new study says that methamphetamine-related hospitalizations are up by several 100% in Pima County, even though meth seizures are down 45%. Today, we'll talk to the author of that study and have a report on the current status of the meth epidemic in our area. Robert Rappaport profiles the Toy Train Museum in downtown Tucson, and Luis Carrion visits with the University of Arizona Drumline. Those stories and more are coming up, but first. There's new information to report in regards to the methamphetamine epidemic in the state. Despite Tucson's recent efforts to limit the sale of ephedrine and pseudoephedrine, which are key ingredients in the production of meth, the drug is still widely available and continues to affect property crime rates in Pima County. According to the Meth Free Alliance, 50% of all property crime in Metro Pima County is meth-related, as well as 66% of all burglary, 56% of all fraud, and 95% of all mail thefts. Captain David Neary is with the Counter Narcotics Alliance. He's also on the board of the Meth Free Alliance. He says meth seizures are down by 45%, but the drug is still very much available.
While a 45% reduction in seizures is significant, and it's something that we take a lot of pride in reporting, the truth is there's still more than enough methamphetamine both available on the street from across the border sources, as well as stuff that's still being made here locally.
City officials knew the ordinance would reduce the number of labs in the city, but wouldn't reduce use of the drug. The ordinance only limits access to pseudoephedrine and ephedrine products in Tucson, but it's still available in the county, unless retailers voluntarily place restrictions on the products.
Because it's just as available as it was in the county, what we have is a good portion of intelligence that what labs that had the strength to continue moved into the county, or those that were in the county simply have grown stronger because now they're more of the only ones that are left. And we're seeing evidence of that as well, because the labs that we are getting information on, the ones that we are able to seize, are coming from county addresses in places like Three Points, Picture Rocks, Ever Valley, et cetera, a little farther out on the west side of town.
And the U.S.-Mexico border continues to play a major role in trafficking of methamphetamine. Captain Neary contends law enforcement is combating meth on two different planes. They're dealing with the local producers and drug traffickers moving the drug through Arizona to other parts of the country.
And that stuff is pretty much destined for other parts of the United States. It's going to the big cities. It's going in big volume. And while we do get a good percentage of that stays here in town, it's nothing like what actually passes through. As a result, those folks are more of the profit-motivated group. They're looking to make their money somewhere else. They're passing through town with the least amount of attention possible.
Another indication that methamphetamine abuse remains high is the number of hospital admissions related to use of the drug. That's according to a recent University of Arizona study conducted by Jim Cunningham, an assistant professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine. It found that for the past 5 years, there's been a dramatic increase in hospital admissions related to meth use in Arizona.
The reason people go to the hospital is because they're having health problems, either mental health or physical health problems. And so by looking at the systematic climb over time, we can say objectively that there are a number of health problems rising with this drug in the neighborhood of several 100% over a few years.
To be exact, a 550% increase in Pima County. And the diagnoses range from overdoses, amphetamine psychosis, seizures, heart attacks, and overheating of the body.
In Arizona, Maricopa historically has been the hotbed of methamphetamine use. Most of the health problems that we've found were in Maricopa, and it typically had the highest rates for hospital admissions. That changed in 2005. Now, Pima County has a rate higher than Maricopa County for hospital admissions related to methamphetamine.
So why are these rates on the rise? 2005 was the first year that meth was associated with the largest number of drug-related admissions for any illicit drug, and the surge is due in large part to the production of meth across the border, which typically has a higher purity level. The study shows that the purity of meth manufactured in Mexico has quadrupled, which could be driving the hospital admissions. In addition, Cunningham found that meth addicts are also using other drugs like cocaine.
In fact, in Pima County, cocaine rates for hospitalizations are higher than those for methamphetamine, although for the state, methamphetamine is the number one drug. And the two drugs somewhat complement one another because they're both stimulants, so people may be going from one to the other, which is, could just be adding to the problem.
The data analyzed in the report was obtained from the Arizona Hospital Discharge System, which is operated by the Arizona Department of Health Services. The study is available at fcm.arizona.edu. If you'd like information about how you can help in the fight against methamphetamine in the community, visit the Meth Free Alliance website at meth-free-alliance.org. Stay tuned to Arizona Spotlight. Up next, Robert Rappaport brings us the sights and sounds of Tucson's Toy Train Operating Museum, which is celebrating a very special anniversary this weekend. That story when we continue with Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. A big event is scheduled for this weekend to highlight a toy train museum in Tucson. Robert Rappaport takes us inside to see what it's all about.
Even though it's nestled in an industrial area, in an unassuming warehouse-type building, toy train enthusiasts come by a couple of times a month to see the trains and even run some of them on the tracks. Known officially as the Gadsden Pacific Division Toy Train Operating Museum, it first began in the Foothills Mall 25 years ago, but moved into its own building in October of 2001. Bob Benzinger is one of the members of the museum.
Well, this is a nonprofit organization. It is 100% volunteer. We're supported by dues from the members, by contributions from the public when they come in to see. Admission is always completely free to this museum, but we do, of course, gratefully accept donations. And also we have a fundraising program where we market custom-made model railroad cars from Arizona Railroads.
Benzinger says what's on display at the museum varies each time it's open.
The museum has plenty of trains that have been donated over the years, but the individual members will bring their own trains. So it's kind of fun to come in on Sundays and just see what everybody's brought. Some days everybody's got steam, some days they've got diesel, passenger. You'll see a mixture like you have today, some passenger trains and some freight trains. But it's all it's all driven by the members, what they want to do. We don't have a lot of operating rules or anything like that. People just bring their trains and run them and talk to the little kids that come here to watch them.
And there are plenty of opportunities for the kids beyond simply watching the trains go by.
There are some operating accessories on the Lionel layout where we can let the kids move the dump truck back and forth in the mine, or the kids can start up the fire truck that's going to put out the fire, that sort of thing.
A lot of the fun is watching the actual train collectors, like Benzinger, describe their toys as they travel the tracks.
Well, this is one of the pinnacles of Art Deco train design. It's the Milwaukee Roads Hiawatha steam streamliner that ran between Chicago and the Twin Cities in the late 1930s and 40s. It was designed by Otto Kuehler, the famous industrial designer, and just everything about it screams Art Deco. It's this particular model, of course, has sound and Not only does the design scream Art Deco, the whistle screams train. It's considered one of the fastest, most luxurious, and most beautiful steam trains ever built. Unfortunately, the Art Deco era ended, and so did the era of steam, and it was built in 1938, and they were all gone by 1952.
Like the whistle on his train, Bob Benzinger says toy trains these days have gone high-tech.
Yeah, these modern trains are amazing. They've got smoke and whistles, and a lot of the sounds on these are actually real digital recordings of real locomotives that have been put on a chip for the sound system that's built into the locomotive. Yeah, this stuff actually is quite high-tech. It's all solid-state, remote-controlled. You've got signals running through the track, and it can all be controlled from a handheld remote.
On a recent Sunday, Steve Wiper, also a member of the train museum, brought his son Devin by to watch his family train.
Well, that was my father's original 1950 or 51 Santa Fe Super Chief by Lionel. And he gave it to me when I was a kid, and now I'm bringing my son down here to get him into trains, which he really loves, you know. So it's that Lionel is now running for three generations in the Wiper family.
Come, Daddy.
What color's Daddy's train?
Red.
Red and silver, that's right. Now that's going to be your tutu now, too.
Longtime Train Museum Club member Ivan English says even in today's high-tech world of video games and computers, little kids and older men still enjoy toy trains, although admittedly not as much as in days past when trains were more common sights. English says toy trains teach kids some basic skills.
You learned about electricity, you learned about building things. I had Erector sets. Gilbert and American Flyer made toy trains. You learned a lot about mechanical. It was a teaching tool in a lot of ways. And I think kids today with their video games miss all of that experience. And so, like I said, as they get older, they're more into video games than this. But I think remote controls, once they learn a little bit about it, they will maybe come back to the interest.
The Gadsden Pacific Toy Train Museum is open the second and fourth Sunday afternoons of each month from 12:30 until 4:30. And member Bob Benzinger says this Sunday will be a special day for the museum and its recently acquired 1942 caboose, which sits in the parking lot.
We have been in operation as an organization, as a museum, for 25 years. We have had this building for 5 years, and we've had our caboose for about a year, and we never had a dedication ceremony for it, so we decided it was time to dedicate our building and our caboose and show it off. Obviously, we've been showing it off to the public, but to make a big splash and show more people what we have.
The anniversary celebration will be held Sunday afternoon from 12:30 until 4:30 at the museum's headquarters at 3975 Miller Avenue, west of Price Street, which is near the intersection of Roger and Romero. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Robert Rappaport.
Up next, Luis Carrion has a feature story on the University of Arizona Drumline. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. The U of A football team may be the focus of all the attention on the gridiron these days, but the Pride of Arizona Drumline can provide its own style of excitement, both on and off the field. Hours and hours of practice means forming a tightly controlled and choreographed technique that certainly rivals any careful play strategy. Luis Carrion reports.
U of A football has all the drama on and off the field. And we, as fans, never know what the season will hold in store for us. But for members of the U of A drumline, the season is marked by endless hours of practice. Many of them under the Aleppo pine trees just off of Cherry Avenue by Arizona Stadium. The U of A drumline is there 3 to 4 times a week practicing the skills that make them arguably one of the best at what they do. It's an unusual scene to encounter as you drive by the intersection, and it's not uncommon for people to stop and watch the group as it rehearses.
And 1, 2, 3, 4.
Antibiotics. My name is Carlos Hermosa. This will be my 3rd year on the drumline. We rehearse about, like, I don't know, 14 hours a week. So it's a lot of time out of our schedule, outside of school, outside of our own personal lives. So it's just an amazing experience. Been drumming ever since I was little. I don't exactly know how little, but been drumming my whole life. And just something about music and drumming has just been kept me coming back and playing and just jamming along.
My name is Lauren Spencer. I play cymbals, and I'm also one of the drumline captains. Through high school, I was in band, and, you know, that's to get your fine arts credit. And I stayed in it throughout high school, and it was just kind of like a natural progression to do it in college. And I had always seen the U of A drumline, and they're just amazing, so I wanted to be a part of that.
If you happen to be a high school student and you're into percussion, it's likely that the U of A drumline is where you want to be when you reach college.
Last but not least, our U of A drumline.
Recently, on a Saturday morning, the drumline held its annual tune-up.
We don't hit, squeeze, and then try and attack at the bottom, because that chokes off the natural rebound and the good sound you're trying to create.
The drumline tune-up is a workshop for local high schools, and it's an opportunity for kids that are working hard to make their school's drumline stand out from the rest to get some hands-on guidance from members of the U of A line.
I'm professor of percussion at the university. I've been here since 1975, which is a long time. And we started this outreach activity about 14 years ago. I think this is the 14th annual drumline tune-up.
For Gary Cook of the U of A School of Music, the drumline tune-up is about cultivating the next generation of drummers and allowing young students to get a feel for what it will take to push their playing to the next level.
The objective is to bring in high school, and we've had on occasion some junior high kids come in, bring in high school percussionists who are into the marching percussion scene, and have a morning with the U of A drumline, part of the Pride of Arizona, and get some instruction in various areas. This year the theme was ensemble and musicality, and we've really seen results, not just because of this, but because of music education in general and percussion education. Over the last 10 years or so, the standards and understanding of instrument selection, tuning, playing style, approach, and all that has just been continually improving.
My name is Saul Aguilar, and I'm the Associate Director of Marching Percussion, and I help teach the drumline here with the Pride of Arizona. We have performances from the U of A drumline for the high school kids, and then we have the high school kids pretty much work with our kids with the U of A drumline, so that, you know, like I said, there's interactive learning here.
Listening how much leverage you have, like when you pull it back here, you have a lot of leverage to play with. But if you're
and we like to believe that we plant a seed, you know, for the kids who are younger and they want to come up, and, you know, when 4 or 5 years later, when they're in college, they want to come out for the U of A drumline, so that they know that there's something more, you know, more to perform at a higher level, basically, you know, than high school. You know, not to say that they're not performing at a higher level in high school now, but it's just for the exposure to see that there's something else out there. That's basically what it comes down to.
The state of music education today has allowed the U of A drumline to reach a level of sophistication that would have been unheard of in years past. However, the essence of playing in the drumline hasn't changed.
I feel a lot of pride being a part of them, and it's just amazing marching with them, so it's really cool.
The motivation for many are the friendships that developed and the pride of being a part of a group that works so hard to perfect the art and skill of the drumline. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Luis Carrion.
When we continue with Arizona Spotlight, Bill Mortimer takes us inside the historic Old Pueblo Trolley. You're listening to Arizona Spotlight on KQAZ. The recent voter-approved regional transportation plan includes more than road construction and repair. Bill Mortimer reports.
There's something magical about them. Judy Garland sang about them, so I paid a visit to them. The trolley car. Well, more specifically, the Old Pueblo trolley. Trolley cars date back in Tucson to 1906. At least the electric ones do. Before that, they were horse or mule drawn. The Tucson trolleys ran until 1930, traveling from the railroad station, then west on Congress to Stone Avenue, turning north on Stone to 3rd Street. There they turned west on 3rd to the University main gate. We know 3rd Street now as University Boulevard. The trolleys as Old Pueblo Trolley came back in 1983. Dick Guthrie is the president and chief operating officer of the Old Pueblo Trolley. Dick, you said you have about 140 volunteers in different capacities for the trolley, and today we'll see four of them.
We'll have a dispatcher, which we have at all times, a motorman, and a conductor, and a trainee. And the trainee is a trained conductor and dispatcher, but is in training to become a motorman.
Tell me more about these volunteers.
We also have restoration personnel that work every Friday and every Saturday, and sometimes during the week. We have maintenance personnel that generally only work on Friday to maintain our vehicles. And then we have track construction personnel that work when we're building track, and the last time we did that was about a little less than a year ago. And then we have a significant number of volunteers who work on our overhead lines, which require special training. And so the largest number we have are the volunteers of Local 1116 of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Well, this takes quite a group of people to keep this line running.
Yes, it does. And those folks who work for Tucson Electric Power come out about four times a year, and we work on the overhead lines.
How many trolley cars are currently in use, Dick?
We have two cars running. The car that we're looking at here is a 1953 Japanese car that was built for operation in Kyoto, Japan. When they went to subways, it was sold to South Osaka and ran in South Osaka until the 9th of June, 1992. We purchased this car on Monday, the 12th of June, 1992, and had it shipped to Tucson the following November. Now we have a second car that will also be running today, and that car was built in 1903 in Bruges, Belgium, for service in Brussels, Belgium.
Now, do you have any additional cars that are in restoration right now that are in process?
Yes, we do, Bill. We have a 1924 tram, that's the European, what the Europeans and the Australians and Japanese call their trolleys, a 1924 tram from Lisbon, Portugal.
The passage of the 20-year, $2 billion RTA plan includes $75 million for a modern streetcar system. Now, they say modern, Dick. What exactly does that entail?
Modern streetcar is a little bit longer than the car we're looking at that we run most days. The one they're talking about is running in two cities right now. Portland, Oregon has eight of them running, and Tacoma, Washington has three running. These are slow speed cars that are strictly one car. They cannot run multiple cars. Slow speed, low floor. They are connector cars that run inside within a core of a city.
The RTA plan, as I understand it, calls for the route to be from the north end of the Health Science Center at the university through the center of downtown into Rio Nuevo, to the west side of the Santa Cruz River. About 3 miles of line should be completed, they say, about the year 2011 or 2012. This will also allow SunTran to eliminate some of its roots. Right now, let's board this beautiful Belgium trolley and take a ride. One of our passengers today is David Small, a university student who has just returned from Japan, where he rode the trolleys in Hiroshima.
Did it appear to be like a tourist attraction, or was it really part of the transportation?
It was both. You know, there was a lot of normal people doing their everyday business, riding them. There were very tourist stops everywhere, so you could get on and off wherever you wanted. And tourists also used it to go between the islands of Hiroshima.
Thank you, David. Our conductor today is Brittany Phillips.
You have to watch, make sure no one's half in, half out when the trolley starts. You run the bells on the other end of the trolley. So two bells is you're ready to go on that end, so he knows that everyone's in, the doors are closed, that kind of thing. If there's an emergency or something needs to stop, one bell, and then he knows that he needs to stop on his end. Pretty much just keeping an eye on everything, making sure everything is going okay.
Well, our ride has ended, so let's talk to the motorman who happens to be Brittany's father, Mark Phillips. Mark, you must be very proud of your daughter working with you.
Been a great experience, to have her with me and, you know, right there with me, and she's taken her interest and her enjoyment and, you know, put it towards, learning to be a conductor. It's a lot of fun. We have a lot of fun doing it together.
Well, thank you, Mark. We felt very safe with you.
Well, thank you very much.
For a family outing, I highly recommend the Old Pueblo Trolleys. They run Friday evenings, 6 until 10 p.m., Saturdays noon till midnight, and Sundays noon till 6 p.m. To learn more about the Old Pueblo Trolley and its exciting future, go online to oldpueblotrolley.org. At the Old Pueblo Trolley, I'm Bill Mortimer for Arizona Spotlight.
And now here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
This weekend on stage, there are plays like On the Verge or The Geography of Yearning being presented by the Cabaret Theater with performances tonight and tomorrow and a Sunday matinee at 2, and a look at the funny side of family life with The Dining Room, a play being put on by the Top Hat Theater Club, 326-6800 for more information. Tonight on the U of A campus, Inti Illimani from Chile will perform world beat music on over 30 indigenous instruments. They're performing at Centennial Hall, where next week Acoustic Africa will be taking the stage on Wednesday night at 7:30. For information about either of these performances, uapresents.org or 621-3341. Coming up on November 4th, there's a concert for the benefit of Temple Bet Shalom. The Jewish Community Center will be hosting Tucson Swings with jazz singer Julianne and great swing and big band music from the 1940s. That's coming up on November 4th, 577-1171. This has been Mark McLemore for Arizona Spotlight.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood with production assistance from Ginger Duran. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Burock.